The fourth area of concern in America today is lawyers and lawsuits. The outgoing president of the American Bar Association, addressing a national convention of lawyers recently, asked the following question. What is the difference between a lawyer and a catfish? After a few moments, he gave the answer. One is a garbage-eating, scum-sucking bottom dweller. The other is just a fish. The heroes and heroines in the legal profession today, the ones who receive grand accolades and standing ovations, are those who have demonstrated the ability to extract massive damage settlements out of gullible juries for questionable offenses. Lawyers and lawsuits are tearing America apart, pitting everyone against everyone else in the legal lottery called Sue Thy Neighbor. They are another example of the E factor and the obsession with getting something for nothing gone crazy. Tort lawyers today, hiding behind the law, have begun some of the most immoral, unethical, and uncaring people in our society. Aided and abetted by judges to whose election campaigns they contribute, and craven politicians, most of whom are paid off by the trial lawyers in the form of campaign contributions, these lawyers are wreaking chaos and destruction everywhere. As soon as the door opened to contingency fees, where lawyers like hucksters, carnival barkers, and used car salesmen work on commission, the flood of frivolous lawsuits began. Today, it's out of control. Only 16% of Americans, according to the Wall Street Journal, feel that the legal system can protect them against frivolous and potentially ruinous lawsuits. In all other countries, and in the U.S. until the 1960s, the legal rule was loser pays. If you filed a lawsuit and lost, you were required to pay the costs of the defense of the other party, plus all other legal expenses. In the 1960s, this rule was eliminated by clever lawyers and compliant judges. Today, anyone can sue anyone for anything, no matter what the basis. If you are sued, you must either hire a lawyer and defend yourself, usually at great cost, or lose the judgment by default. Since it is fairly easy to find a lawyer who will bring a lawsuit against you on contingency, and impossible to find a lawyer who will defend you without advance payment, you can spend a fortune defending yourself against a completely frivolous claim while the other person suing you pays nothing. Tort lawyers claim to be concerned about getting justice for the little guy. They loudly proclaim that their only concern is to represent injured people who, except for contingency fees, could not otherwise afford to hire them. In reality, these lawyers are examples of the E factor run amok. They are often smooth-talking, slick operators who easily mislead both complainants and defendants into believing that they care about justice and righting wrongs. They purport to be working for the powerless against the powerful. In reality, they are more often rapacious, greedy professionals driven mad by the smell of free money, just as piranhas in the Amazon are driven wild by the smell of blood. Many of them make millions of dollars each year in extortion-like lawsuits, and a few of them have even become billionaires. The most successful tort lawyers are the worst and the most unethical of all. They have developed the ability to smell out cases where they can emotionally manipulate a jury into granting huge damages for questionable offenses or for no offenses at all. Vice presidential candidate John Edwards, whose father was a mill worker, is reportedly worth $70 million today, most of it earned suing doctors and hospitals for not having performed enough cesarean births, thereby supposedly causing the child to be born with cerebral palsy. Exhaustive medical research has proven that there is zero relationship between the number of cesarean births and cerebral palsy in children. Instead, it is a genetic defect that is undetectable and incurable. Nonetheless, John Edwards is rich today, and many doctors have had their careers destroyed. These lawyers are extraordinarily skilled at what is called jury selection. Identifying compliant jurors, they know they can manipulate easily. They contribute heavily to the candidacies of judges who they will soon appear before arguing their cases. They use a network of junk scientists, pseudo-experts who move from court to court to testify again and again on the basis of questionable science or data. One radiologist profiled recently had examined 32,000 x-rays sent to him by tort lawyers and found that all 32,000 had asbestos-related scarring. Recently, the x-rays of several hundred people who had sued for asbestos-related injuries were carefully scrutinized by an objective panel of radiologists, whereas the junk science doctors who had testified for the complainants had found asbestos-related scarring in 96% of the x-rays, the objective panel of radiologists found asbestos scarring in only 4% of the x-rays submitted for examination. Every year, countless millions of dollars are awarded to people based on this type of science. The threats and costs of lawsuits have driven many doctors out of medicine and increased health care costs for the average person by 25 to 50%. Because of the out-of-control tort lawsuits brought against any doctor when any procedure is unsuccessful, more and more people are unable to get medical attention in certain states and parts of the country. According to estimates, lawsuits and the threats of lawsuits cost the average family of four an additional $3,200 per year in increased costs. This money has to be paid in higher prices for products of lower quality. It comes out of the pockets of the average working man and off of their tables. It is money they don't have to spend on their wives and children. The only solution for an out-of-control legal system is clear legislation that brings back the loser-pays principle and strictly limits legal liability. The entire structure of incentives in the tort industry must be upended. It must not be possible for clever lawyers, interested only in getting something for nothing or very little, to ply their evil wares. The fifth area of concern in America today is gambling. We call this rolling the dice. Gambling is perhaps the most perfect example of the desire to get something for nothing. The whole idea behind gambling is that there is some fast, easy way to get money that you have not earned. Proponents of legalized gambling declare that it is an innocent form of entertainment, fun for the whole family. But gamblers always lose eventually. It's only a matter of time. The billion-dollar casinos and gambling resorts have not been built with losses. According to economist Alan Meister in his new Indian Gaming Industry Report, the nation's 405 Indian casinos generated about $19 billion in revenues last year, up from zero a few years ago. In other estimates, these tribes and casinos contributed more than $800 million in 2004 to various politicians, making them the biggest and most powerful political lobbying group in the world, if not in the history of the world. Not surprisingly, most tribal casino revenues are almost impossible to verify. No one knows for sure how much is going to which people for what purposes. The main objection to gambling is not that most people are losing money that could be better spent on their families. The worst aspect of the gambling bug is that it destroys the capacity of the gambler to deal with reality. According to psychologists, when gamblers win, they consider it to be a matter of personal skill. When they lose, however, they define the situation not as losing, but as almost winning. They create a fantasy world around gambling, and then they attempt to live inside it. Gambling corrupts the soul and makes the gambler negative, distrustful, and angry. Continued losing undermines his self-esteem and destroys his self-respect. For every gambling loss, there is an opponent, as in poker, or a dealer, croupier, as in blackjack or roulette, who wins. The loser is always being defeated by someone visible and real. As a result, he ends up feeling frustrated and bitter. He feels like a loser. The act of gambling opens up the mind to every other possibility of getting something for nothing. And, like a syphilis parachute, the gambling idea soon lodges in the brain, causing a form of insanity, destroying both the person and his or her family. A reporter for National Review wrote recently, "I have been to hell and returned. It is a place called Las Vegas in the Nevada desert." He went on to write about the casinos filled with working men and women, grim-faced, betting and losing their rent money, money that could be better spent on their children. Anyone who's ever walked through a casino has noticed the strained faces and lack of joy among the people for whom the loss of their hard-earned money is only a matter of time. It's not possible to outlaw gambling, but it is like an addictive narcotic The only way you can avoid its destructive effects is to avoid it altogether. You can recognize that it is an attempt to get something for nothing, which is inherently wrong. Even worse, it weakens your immoral immune system and makes you susceptible to other temptations to get something for nothing. The sixth area of concern today is health, energy, and longevity. We know the desire to be fit, healthy, and live a long life is perhaps the most common of all human desires and the basic need of all human beings. George Gilder said recently that longevity is now the most precious of all commodities in our society. Where did people ever get the idea that medical attention was a right to be guaranteed to them by a benevolent government or employer at little or no cost? The something-for-nothing virus runs rampant in all areas of healthcare today. People do things to their bodies that are virtually guaranteed to undermine their health and shorten their lives. They then demand that the medical and pharmaceutical industry somehow take responsibility to return them to health and wholeness at little or no cost to themselves. Everyone today knows that the 5-word formula for health and fitness is simply to eat less and exercise more. It has never been otherwise. These 5 words summarize the best findings of hundreds of books and thousands of articles. The key is to practice them daily. Eat less and exercise more. The epidemic of obesity, with 60% of Americans either overweight or seriously overweight, is a direct result of thinking that you can have health for nothing. Obesity numbers grow as more people become addicted to something for nothing in other areas of their lives. They soon begin to see themselves as victims. They resent others who are fit and trim. They lash out and blame either their hormones or the companies that sell them the food that they eat too much of. In a third-party payer system of company health insurance at HMOs, most people consume medical services without knowing or caring how much they really cost. It doesn't matter to them as long as someone else is paying for it. Medical attention is loudly trumpeted as a right, but every right includes a responsibility. If you have the right to medical attention, this means that someone else has the responsibility of providing it to you. Someone has to pay. No one assumes a right to food, clothing, shelter, or transportation, even though they are all basic necessities of life. These factors all have to be earned and paid for according to your capacity. Economists say there is no demand curve for a free good. What this means is that if something of value is free, the demand for that commodity soon becomes unlimited. People will consume as much of it as they possibly can without restraint. In Canada, which is often held up as a model of national health care, medicine is supposedly free. However, you know that nothing is really free. Everything has to be paid for by someone somehow. The truth is that medical care costs about 13% of the Canadian GNP and is inferior to U.S. medical care in every way. In the U.S., by contrast, medical costs run at about 14% of GNP, but because these costs are largely determined in a free market, we have the best medical system in the world. Anyone who has experienced both systems will attest to the night and day difference between them. This is why people come from Canada and all over the world to seek medical treatment in the U.S., but people in the U.S. seldom go to any other country. In Canada, to stop runaway costs from bankrupting the government, medical care is carefully rationed. Hospitals are shut down to limit use. If you are over 60, it becomes harder and harder to get treated for chronic illnesses. The waiting lists are endless, usually many months or even longer. Not only that, it is a crime punishable by imprisonment in Canada for either a doctor to offer treatment outside the national system or for a patient to pay for treatment that is not sanctioned by the government. Everyone must wait in the same line and get the same treatment by law. This may, however, be coming to an end. In 2005, the Quebec Supreme Court kicked the chair out from under the free Canadian health system by ruling that access to a waiting list is not access to health care, as guaranteed by the Canadian Bill of Rights. In the United States, because of competition and the free market, virtually anyone can get care for almost any need quickly and efficiently. Even a person with no health insurance, no address, and no visible means of support can go to the outpatient department of any hospital in America and get treatment for an accident or an emergency without charge. This is the law. The inescapable fact is that each person is responsible for his or her own level of fitness, weight, and health. There is no something for nothing in health and longevity. Everything must be paid for by someone. Nothing is ultimately free. One of the problems of healthcare insurance today is that too many people look upon buying this insurance as a gamble, like shooting craps or playing blackjack. Sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. They call this the healthcare insurance crisis. According to careful analysis, however, only about 3% of people without health insurance in America are in that situation involuntarily. Most people without health insurance have decided to gamble that they won't be sick or injured. They choose instead to spend their money on their lifestyles or other things. Many of these uninsured have annual incomes of $50,000 or more. Just as there are people who avoid buying liability or accident insurance for their cars, gambling that they will not get into an accident, there are people who decline to insure themselves medically, hoping that they will not need medical attention. The reality is that health insurance is only another term for prepaid medical expenses. Health insurance premiums are set based upon accurate projections and estimates of what a person is likely to spend per year on health services. Health insurance premiums are simply monies that are pooled to pay for the inevitable and predictable healthcare costs when they come. It's not possible to get health for nothing, fitness for nothing, long life for nothing. The price of health and longevity must always be paid sooner or later. The solution to the so-called healthcare crisis in America is private health accounts where individuals pay for their own health care and insurance and keep the savings when they manage their health intelligently. The best solution of all would be to allow all Americans the incredibly wide range of choices and options for health care that all elected officials, even when retired, and all members of government unions receive at taxpayers' expense. Our health care problems would be over. The seventh area of concern is the families of America. Parents and children are the fundamental unit of our society. In thinking about the long term, they are also the most important. The primary purpose of each generation is to bring up and provide for the next generation. How a child is raised to adulthood not only impacts that child, but his or her spouse, their children, their children's children, and on into the third and fourth generations. Each of us is still affected as an adult by the way our grandparents treated our parents when they were growing up. Government cannot raise children. It can only create an environment in which children can be brought up happy, healthy, and self-sufficient. The responsibility for raising happy, healthy children lies with their parents. No child asks to be born, but once born, his parents are responsible for providing for him in every way, physically, mentally, and emotionally. Many parents want to get something for nothing in child-rearing. They want to be seen as excellent parents without paying the price that this requires. How does a child spell love? Answer, T-I-M-E. The value of each relationship in your life is determined by how much of your personal time that you invest in it. You can only increase the value and quality of a relationship by investing more minutes and hours in one-on-one, face-to-face, heart-to-heart communications with your spouse and children. Something-for-nothing parents try to get by on the cheap, spending their precious and irreplaceable time in all the wrong places. The solution to the problems of marriage and parenting is simple. Spend more time with the people you care about the most. Psychologists estimate that 85% of your happiness in life will come from relationships with others. Only 15% of life satisfaction comes from external results, rewards, and accomplishments. No one on his deathbed ever said, "I wish I'd spent more time at the office." The key to self-esteem, self-respect, and personal pride is to place your important relationships in the center of your life, as the sun in your personal solar system, and organize all the other activities of your life to orbit around them. An eighth concern in America today is environmentalism and activism. The desires to do good and to improve the lives of others, to save the world, are the first fallback positions of a person seeking meaning and purpose in life. Virtually all forms of environmentalism and activism are clear illustrations of the something-for-nothing drive gone out of control. Abigail Adams once wrote, "All men would be tyrants if they could." Nietzsche called it the will to power. This applies to many women as well. There is a dark streak deep in the soul of many people that drives them to want to command and control others. As Lord Acton wrote, "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Even the thought of obtaining power over others corrupts the soul." Well-meaning people seeking something bigger than themselves to believe in often become interested in a cause of some kind that they feel is important to society, like saving the environment or the whales. In too many cases, these people are unemployed or unemployable. They have time on their hands and few prospects. They seek something to which they can dedicate themselves. They then become what Eric Hoffer called the true believers, going from cause to cause throughout their lives. The first thing these people discover, much to their shock and amazement, is that many people are either indifferent to their worthy causes or completely hostile to their ideas. The second thing they discover is that they need money if they're going to accomplish anything. Of course, they need money to underwrite their activities, but especially they need money to pay their personal bills. Suddenly, the something-for-nothing bug bites them. They begin looking for ways to get money from others to pursue their activities, to further their causes. They then notice that there are lots of other people trying to get money for other worthy causes in competition with them. To survive, they become more determined to make their case and win support. To compete with others, they're forced to make a better case, preferably loudly and publicly. They look around for politicians who think that by espousing a particular cause, they can get more votes. They gather members to more effectively impress their potential political sponsors. As always happens, the worst people in these movements, the most clever and passionate, soon rise to the top and take over. They open offices, hire people, begin lobbying and looking for ever more free money to pay the bills. Hierarchies form within these organizations. Salaries are paid. People start to make good money, often more than they've ever made before. The single most burning, intense desire of these people is to get the government to seize control of property and assets. They want to force people to do things that they would not do voluntarily, but which the activists feel they should be made to do. In the case of environmentalists, for example, they want control and power for nothing. They want to control land or property they don't own and won't buy. To whip up more support, they blame the situation that they feel requires mending on someone somewhere. Once they have decided on a villain, an enemy, usually someone who owns a business or property, they pull out all stops to demonize him and get control of his assets. For example, a few years ago, an environmental group needing money made up the Alar scare. The entire nation was subjected to televised hearings, listening to actress Meryl Streep and others creating a panic, decrying the danger of Alar in apples. By the time this junk science had been refuted, and it was proven that no one, anywhere, had ever been harmed by Alar, which had been used as a preservative for 50 years, the damage was done. Hundreds of apple growers had their crops destroyed, and many of them went bankrupt. When the dust finally settled, the environmental group that had orchestrated the national panic admitted that they had needed a big scare to raise funds to keep their organization going. Jobs and paychecks, something for nothing, were at stake. The drive behind most activism is something for nothing as well. These organizations need money to pay salaries and expenses. The only source of this unearned money are individuals or corporate donors, and of course the government. Their product is the ability to activate public opinion and scare opportunistic politicians with their numbers. In return, these environmentalists and activists get money and power they have not earned and do not deserve. They create jobs for themselves with paychecks, expense accounts, and junkets to conferences where they often travel in limousines and stay at beautiful hotels. They often spend most of the money they raise on expenses, with very little actually going to the worthy cause. The only solution to environmentalism and activism out of control is to expose them for what they are: thieves posing as concerned citizens, supposedly motivated by compassion, but actually obsessed with dispossessing others of their money and property. You can tell if these people are sincere in their convictions by a simple test. How much of their own money have they personally invested in furthering their cause? In most cases, they have no money of their own at all. They are poor and look to activism as a way to create jobs for themselves and their friends. In some cases, they do have money, but they very seldom spend any of their own money on the causes that they believe that other people should contribute to. All they want is something for nothing, but coming to them, not from them. In every area of human life and activity, the E factor reigns supreme. Like gravity, it is to be assumed in advance as the basic operating principle of all human behavior. The onus of proof must be on the person who denies that he is acting expediently to prove that he is not lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient. This turns out to be almost impossible to do. Each person in each position in any organization, especially political organizations where there are no measurable performance standards, is lazy, greedy, selfish, ambitious, vain, ignorant, and impatient. He strives for money and power to get the safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment he desires. The only variable, the only modifying influence in the ABC formula of human performance is the structure of incentives. The only difference between people is how they choose to go about accomplishing their common ends. Men and women of character think long term. They think about the secondary consequences of their behaviors. They strive to get the things they want through voluntary cooperation. They practice honesty, integrity, and openness with others. The results of their behaviors turn out to be beneficial for everyone involved, both in the short term and in the long term. Further down the scale of human character, too many people behaving expediently engage in dishonest and corrupt behaviors to get the things they want the fastest and easiest way possible. They are not concerned about the long-term effects of their actions. The way to solve any human problem is by a return to values. It is first of all to clarify exactly the values that the organization or individual stands for, and then to organize all the activities of the individual or organization so that they behave consistent with those values, no matter what the short-term temptations might be. Only in this way can the irresistible power of the E factor be banked, channeled, and directed toward positive outcomes that benefit everyone involved. Chapter 12, America and the World. As Alistair Cook once said, people, when they first come to America, whether as travelers or settlers, become aware of a new, agreeable feeling that the whole country is their oyster. America is a great country, easily the best country in all of human history, on any measure you care to use. As it happens, citizens of every country feel that their own country is superior in some way to all others, whether or not this idea is based on fact, but in the case of the United States, it's true. American exceptionalism is well-founded, rooted in the ideas of the American Revolution. Americans are an exceptional people in many measurable and quantifiable ways. Does this mean that Americans are superior? Of course not. America is a melting pot made up of people from every nation in the world. However, Americans who embrace the American ideals are exceptional on the basis of provable and objective measures. As I mentioned earlier, there are four elements of the good life that people the world over have sought throughout history. These are the core ingredients that make for happiness as a human being. Each country can be graded on a scale measuring how many of these key goals are achievable by how many people and how long the average person has to work to achieve them. The first element of a good life consists of health, energy, and longevity. American medicine, at all levels, is the finest in the world. Individuals from any economic group can live longer and live better in America than has ever been possible before. One of the fastest-growing age groups in the United States is the population over 100 years old. No one ever leaves America to seek medical attention in other countries. But anyone who can afford the cost comes to America when they cannot get the medical attention they need in their home country. The second ingredient of the good life is a happy, healthy family, characterized by high-quality human relationships at home and in one's community. More than any other measure, the ability of individuals and their families to achieve the basic human goals of security, safety, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment is more possible for people living in America than for residents of any other country. The third ingredient of the good life is meaningful, well-paid work that one enjoys and which one feels makes a difference in society. The United States has the most flexible, wide-open labor market in the world, where anyone from anywhere can come and rise as high and as fast as he desires, solely based on his own effort and his own willingness to make a valuable contribution to the lives and work of others. American workers enjoy the highest standards of living of any people in the world and have more than 100,000 different jobs to choose from. The final ingredient, the icing on the cake that constitutes the good life, is the achievement of financial independence. Perhaps the greatest fear that people have is the fear of poverty, of being broke or destitute, especially in old age. In the United States, it is more possible for more people in more different ways to achieve financial independence and provide for their retirement than in perhaps any other country. Today, our senior citizens are the most affluent of any senior group in history. The Secretary of Education, Bill Bennett, was once asked by a high school student, "How can you tell if the United States is a good country or not?" He replied, "That's simple. You just use the GATE test." "What is the GATE test?" asked the student. "Well," replied Secretary Bennett, "just raise the gates and watch which way the people go." Well, people from 194 countries have flocked to the United States for more than 200 years, arriving both legally 1 million per year and illegally 21 million as of 2004. These people have surged through the open gates to participate in the American dream of hope and opportunity. One of the main jobs of the United States in the world is to remain the guardian of the American dream. There's no other country in the world or in history that has had the word dream attached to it. There's no German dream or French dream or Russian dream. There's only the American dream. In his 1986 State of the Union speech, President Ronald Reagan, addressing the joint session of Congress, said, "America is the first country in the world where nobody cares who your parents were." He said, "You can move to Paris and live there all your life and never be accepted as French. You can move to London and live there all your life and never be accepted as British. You can move to Berlin and live all your life and never be accepted as German. But you can move to America and be accepted as an American from the first day." There's another reason for the well-founded notion of American exceptionalism. There are dozens of admirable human qualities, but the seven great virtues are probably those of integrity, courage, industriousness, generosity, sincerity, responsibility, and persistence. These qualities may be possessed by individuals from every nationality to one degree or another, but there is no country on earth where these qualities are more encouraged and rewarded than in the United States. There is something in the philosophic, democratic, spiritual, emotional, and idealistic climate of the United States that conspires to bring out the highest and best of these qualities in the greatest number of people. These qualities form the foundation for the entrepreneurial boldness and energy that has made the United States the innovative industrial and technological powerhouse of the world for more than 100 years. America, starting off as an unexplored continent 400 years ago, produces more goods and services than all 25 countries of Europe together, even though many of them go back 2,000 years or more. America shares her wealth by giving more in foreign aid, public and private, each year than all the other countries in the world put together. America is a great country because its people, in the main, are idealistic, generous, entrepreneurial, hardworking, visionary, and courageous. These qualities are held in higher esteem in America than they are in any other country, where they are often under continuous attack. An article in a French newspaper recently, decrying the booming free market economy of America, characterized by high levels of entrepreneurial activity and continuous job changing, contained these words. It said, "We have no interest in the American economic system. We French prefer a tightly regulated and highly controlled way of life. After all, America is made up of the people who left. France is made up of the people who stayed." Americans fought for the ideals of freedom, liberty, individualism, personal responsibility, and limited government in the Revolutionary War, and have labored and fought for them ever since. This can be said of no other country. The American Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights are thought by many to be divinely inspired. The United States was designed from the beginning to be the last best hope of mankind, a place where anyone could come and create a better life. America was the first country that was set up to be supportive of the best interests of the little guy. President Calvin Coolidge once said, "The business of America is business." By this he meant that the business of America is to protect, preserve, and promote the capitalist system of free enterprise. This is the greatest system ever discovered and developed to create hope, opportunity, and wealth for the greatest number of people. Americans working together in peaceful cooperation, within a framework of law and order, have created a system that pours out an almost unimaginable cornucopia of products and services to improve the lives and work of the average person. It is our system and the remarkable melting pot of Americans who thrive within it that has made America the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world. It is not our natural resources, but our national spirit that is the basis of American exceptionalism. It makes the United States different and superior to all other countries. After being defeated in World War II, Germany was divided into four zones of occupation: the American, British, French, and Russian. It was generally believed at that time that there was a militaristic impulse within the German people that caused them to make war on their neighbors. The country was broken up so that this could not happen again, as it had just happened in World War I and World War II. However, detailed work by historians in the next few years found that Germany was no more or no less of a warmongering nation than many other countries. In fact, in European history, it turned out that Sweden had initiated more wars of conquest than any other nation, followed closely by France. Germany was third. The question then became, what is it that causes a nation to go to war? The answer they discovered was insightful and revealing. The historians concluded that whenever a nation reached a critical size or level of power relative to its neighbors and felt that it could attack another nation and win, that nation became an aggressor and went to war. The only factor that stopped nations from going to war throughout history was the conclusion of the leaders that they could not succeed. If they went to war, they would be worse off as a result. The price was too high. To forestall this natural warlike tendency, nations entered into alliances with other nations to maintain balances of power against potentially aggressive countries. These balances of power shifted continually as nations rose and fell in terms of their military capability. But throughout history, every nation, if it grew powerful enough in its own estimate, would become an aggressor and attack whatever nation or nations it considered weak and vulnerable to conquest. In other words, the thought of getting something for nothing in conquering another country turned out to be the primary motivator of war, militarism, and imperialism throughout history. The French Revolution was supposedly based on liberty, equality, and fraternity, noble ideals for mankind. But when French forces under Napoleon attacked and dominated all of Europe in every direction, the very first action of the French troops upon conquering a city or country was to loot and plunder, sending cartloads and shiploads of gold, silver, jewels, and artwork back to Paris. The very first act of the Nazis when they overran Europe in 1939 to 1945 was to loot and plunder the banks, treasuries, and art collections of the conquered lands. When Russia pushed the Nazis back in Eastern Europe, the very first act of the Russian occupying forces was to loot and plunder whatever was left. When the Japanese invaded Manchuria in 1938 and then China, loot and plunder was at the top of the list. When they went on to invade Hong Kong, the Philippines, Indochina, Malaysia, and Singapore, looting took precedence over all other activities. Regardless of all claims of national purpose or high philosophy, the primary reason for initiating aggressive wars has always been to loot and plunder, to attempt to get something for nothing, as much for as long as possible. The historians who carried out this study came to a remarkable conclusion. They found, alone amongst all the nations of history, America was the only country that had reached critical mass with the size and power necessary to overrun other countries, which had refused to become an imperial power. In simple terms, as far as the United States was concerned, the business of America is business. There was and still exists a deep strain of isolationism in the American character, protected on both sides by huge oceans, the United States just wants to be left alone to carry on and conduct its business in the most profitable way for the greatest good of the greatest number of Americans. Both in World War I and World War II, America entered late into the conflict. In fact, there were an enormous number of Americans, sometimes a majority, who had no interest whatever in participating in European or Asian wars. It was only after American ships were attacked in World War I and Pearl Harbor was attacked in World War II that America roused from its slumber and went to war. But when the war was over, the United States withdrew most of its troops, shut down its war machine, and went back to business. This history is often forgotten or willfully ignored by dishonest politicians and journalists. When a television commentator questioned Secretary of State Colin Powell in 2003, he demanded to know why it was that the United States was going to war in Afghanistan and Iraq and becoming an imperial power. General Powell replied, referring to U.S. efforts in World War II, "When all these conflicts were over, what did we do?" he said. "Did we stay and conquer? Did we say, okay, we defeated Germany, now Germany belongs to us? We defeated Japan, so Japan belongs to us?" No. What did we do? We built them up. We gave them democratic systems, which they have embraced, totally to their soul. And did we ask for any land? No. The only land we have ever asked for is enough land to bury our dead. And that is the kind of nation we are. Alone in the world, America remains the great power. In all of human history, America is the only country that has never expanded by using its military might to conquer and colonize other nations. The interests of America in foreign policy have almost always been the maintenance of relations with other nations that support the democratic free enterprise business system. Foreign policy has always been aimed at creating or maintaining a situation in the world that assures a steady flow of imports, a steady market for exports, and a good climate for business. George Washington once said, "Nations have no friends, only interests." All nations act in their own best interests. The politicians and diplomats of the United States are charged by the American people to make decisions and take actions that are in the best interests of the United States. To derogatorily accuse America of acting in its own best interest in foreign affairs suggests that the accuser is a very stupid person and completely ignorant of the way the world works. Historian Arnold Toynbee identified 26 large empires that had risen and fallen throughout history, beginning with the Persian Empire in 600 BC, all the way through to the Japanese Empire, which collapsed in 1945. The only one still standing was the American Empire. For most of history, well into the 20th century and even the 21st century, the world has been governed by tyrannies, dictatorships, megalomaniacs, and empires of all kinds. In most countries in the world today, especially in Africa, the Middle East, and South America, corruption, thievery, deceit, treachery, and murder are the normal state of affairs. Most Americans living in Fortress America do not realize that outside of the Western countries, which are largely governed by law, much of the world is governed by corrupt and dishonest dictators and politicians who lie, cheat, and steal continually. In America, integrity is highly respected and valued. It is demanded not only in positions of leadership, but at all levels of society. According to Francis Fukuyama in his best-selling book, Trust, America is one of the highest trust nations in the world and in history. Lying, cheating, and stealing are not acceptable in America and are both discouraged and punished, socially and legally. When it takes place, as in the corporate scandals following the 1990s boom, it is aggressively investigated and rooted out. The worst thing you can do to a public or private figure is to impugn his integrity, to suggest that he is dishonest in some way. In other countries, there is much greater acceptance for or resignation about corruption in high places. For example, in the 2004 World Corruption Index, France came in at number 18, just below Botswana. Behaviors that are overlooked or ignored in France would lead to removal from office in the United States. This is true in many other countries as well. To preserve peace and stability in the world, and sometimes to achieve it, America has had no choice but to build powerful and far-reaching armed forces. Without the imposition of U.S. forces in Germany between 1945 and 1991, the USSR would probably have overrun Western Europe, again, to loot and plunder. Without the presence of U.S. forces in the Far East, the mainland Chinese would have overrun Taiwan and Hong Kong. North Korea might have invaded South Korea again in the absence of American forces. Even the conflict in Vietnam was motivated by a desire to help an ally and to defeat an enemy that was fully supported by Russia and Red China. In every case, however well or poorly U.S. forces have been deployed, the goal was always to achieve or maintain peace and world trade from which the people of the U.S. directly and indirectly would benefit. In achieving these aims, the United States produces about 30% of all the goods and services in the world, with only 6% of its population. In order to support its massive industrial base, it requires energy of all kinds, including oil. Today, the U.S. imports about 53% of its oil needs, with fully 23% of that coming from the Middle East, especially Saudi Arabia. Any curtailment of the flow of oil from the Middle East would deal a severe blow to the United States and to European economies, as well as to Japan and China. For 50 years, the Middle East was left to itself. It consists of 22 impoverished states, all run by dictators and thugs, and controlled by secret police, where there exist no rights for women, no rights to property, no legal systems, and no safety or security for the average man or woman. But as long as the oil continued to flow from the oil fields along the Persian Gulf, the problems in that area were not considered to be the business of America. It was not our job to interfere with the internal activities of sovereign nations in the Middle East. Historically, the Middle East and the Arab nations have been some of the most backward and impoverished areas of the world. It was only when American entrepreneurs like J. Paul Getty invested enormous amounts of money searching for oil in Saudi Arabia that these countries had any source of wealth whatsoever. Today, aside from oil royalties and revenues, Finland, with 1/50th the population of the Middle East, exports more products than all the countries of the Middle East put together. All of the oil riches in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Abu Dhabi, Yemen, and each country where oil has been discovered by American or European companies have been seized by the dictatorships, despots, and the royal families of those countries. Overnight, they were infected with the something-for-nothing disease. From impoverished, nomadic tribes, they suddenly became some of the richest people in the world. They eagerly divided up this loot amongst themselves, their families, and their close associates. But no amount was ever enough. No matter how much they got, they wanted and spent more and more. Meanwhile, their populations languished in poverty in the 100-degree-plus desert sun. Today, the populations of the Arab countries, even those with fabulous oil riches and countless tens of billions of dollars gushing into their bank accounts, are some of the most impoverished and wretched people on earth. Somehow, trickle-down economics doesn't work in non-democratic societies. When Saddam Hussein and Iraq evaded Kuwait in 1990 with the primary aim of, first of all, wiping out tens of billions of dollars of debt, and second of all, looting and plundering the oil-rich state, the situation in the Middle East changed dramatically, and the United States had to intervene. In conjunction with 30 other countries, including France and Germany, the U.S. mobilized its forces, drove the Iraqi army out of Kuwait, and defeated the fourth largest army in the world in a battle lasting 104 hours, with limited casualties on the U.S. side. Then, consistent with decades of U.S. policy in the Middle East, with the job done and Kuwait liberated, the U.S. military largely packed up and went home. For the next 10 years, Saddam Hussein defied UN resolutions and restrictions. He mass-murdered more than 300,000 Shiites who disagreed with him and his Sunni supporters. Year by year, he intensified his terrorization of his own people, brutally torturing and murdering thousands of men, women, and children while he plundered his own country. While his people suffered for lack of food and medicine, Saddam Hussein built dozens of massive palaces for himself and his family all over the country. Then came 9/11. Almost 3,000 Americans were suddenly and brutally mass-murdered by suicidal Islamist fanatics. Throughout the Middle East, people danced in the streets and cheered when they heard about the bombing of the Twin Trade Center towers and the jet flying into the Pentagon. Fanatics proclaimed everywhere that this was the beginning of the war against the great Satan. On that day, the world changed forever. The United States immediately mobilized its allies, swept into Afghanistan from all sides, and defeated the Taliban in less than a month, something the USSR had been unable to accomplish in 13 years after suffering more than 50,000 casualties. Meanwhile, Saddam Hussein, who had almost built a nuclear reactor at Osirak some years before, continued to defy UN resolutions to disarm. In 1998, he ordered the weapons inspectors out of Iraq and began acting in every way as if he had weapons of mass destruction to hide from the Allied powers. He publicly gave $25,000 each to the families of suicide bombers in Israel, a U.S. ally, and hinted at further attacks on U.S. interests. President George Bush, in his speech to Congress in 2003, said, "The world's worst people must not be allowed to get control of the world's worst weapons." U.S. state policy, which had been reactive and defensive for 200 years, suddenly changed. Under President George Bush, the United States decided upon a doctrine of preemption for the first time in U.S. history. From then on, the U.S. would attack first if there was a possibility of an attack like 9/11 that would kill innocent Americans. But Saddam Hussein was not stupid. For the 12 years since being defeated in the Gulf War, he had been forging economic ties with the French, Russians, Germans, and even the Chinese. He had promised the development of the Tikrit oil fields, containing $17 trillion worth of oil, to France if they would keep supporting his dictatorship and keep the Americans out of Iraq. Records found in Baghdad after the 2003 Iraq War included a list of 270 people who had been bribed with Iraqi oil during the UN embargo, including the top people at the UN in charge of monitoring the embargo and revenue flows. Initial estimates of the amount stolen come to $10 billion. And this is probably just the tip of the iceberg. Politicians and business people throughout Europe and the world turn out to have been on Saddam's payroll. Something for nothing had struck again. The prospect of millions and billions of oil dollars flowing into Swiss accounts quickly got the French, German, Russian, and Belgians to link arms to block the U.S. invasion, but to no avail. The purpose of invading Iraq was to rid the world of a murderous dictator who controlled unlimited billions of dollars and who was prepared to provide arms, money, and resources to terrorists who would strike America and Americans anywhere. The choice was simple: either fight and defeat the terrorists in Iraq, or fight them in the streets of the United States. The U.S. decided to invade Iraq. It was the correct choice. Many people don't understand the unique and special role of America in the world today. Either as a result of ignorance or cowardice or both, they've become detached from reality. Where did they ever get the idea that the United States could be the richest and most powerful country in the world without accepting the vast responsibilities that go along with that position of power? Who ever said that America could have power, affluence, opportunity, and growth on the cheap, and that we could achieve and maintain our greatness in the world at no cost? The Bible says, "From those to whom much has been given, much is expected." The United States and the people of America are perhaps the most blessed in the world, and this means that we owe a lot. Much is expected from us. We have huge responsibilities. There is no such thing as something for nothing in world affairs. The central responsibility of our leaders is to act in our best interests, to protect and preserve our inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. No sane person wants war, with the suffering and death that war always entails. But no responsible leader can fail to act when the stakes are so high. Now you hear the question, why do they hate us? This question is repeated over and over by people who think that the most important goal that America should have is to be liked by other countries. But the approval or disapproval of other countries can be extremely shallow. It blows in the wind. It comes and goes and changes like the weather. It is not reliable and therefore not particularly valuable in most cases. First of all, most people in the world admire and look up to America and the American ideals of freedom, liberty, and opportunity. These are the dreams and hopes of all people everywhere, and America represents the highest expression of these ideals ever achieved by any nation in history. But the twin emotions of envy and resentment lie just beneath the surface, waiting to be triggered by a person or event. In talking with people throughout Europe, Asia, and Australia, as well as all over America, you often hear them say, "George Bush is dumb. George Bush is an out-of-control cowboy. George Bush is a warmonger. George Bush is controlled by a neocon cabal," etc., etc. Since very few people think seriously or read extensively in these areas, When people holding these opinions are asked where they get their ideas, they ultimately refer to the newspapers and television programs. Where did these newspaper and television stories originate? Well, it turns out that virtually every anti-American, anti-Bush story is an almost verbatim attack from Democratic partisans who are still angry about the fact that George Bush won the election for the presidency in 2000. Fully 89% of newsmakers in radio, television, newspapers, and magazines identify themselves as Democratic supporters who dislike and disagree with Bush and the Republicans and have felt this way virtually all of their adult lives. Their anti-Bush accusations are therefore repeated over and over until more and more people start to believe them. This is the standard use of the big lie theory, which says that if you repeat a lie often enough, in enough different forms, eventually a considerable number of people will begin to believe it. In Europe, it turns out that many of the anti-American journalists and newsmakers were on the Iraqi payroll. Many of the sources of the news and newspaper stories constantly attacking and belittling George Bush turn out to be straight reprints in the European newspapers from the American newspapers. Democratic-inspired attacks on Republicans and Bush are reprinted worldwide as if they were facts. When people in Europe or Asia are told that George Bush is known to be an honest, intelligent, hard-working, non-drinking family man with degrees from both Harvard and Yale, they're astonished. When they learn that fully 50% or more of Americans like and respect George Bush, their jaws drop. When George Bush won the 2004 presidential election by more than 3 million votes, they were incredulous. They had been led to believe that he was extraordinarily unpopular in America. The major reason for this confusion is what they, and Americans for that matter, read in the newspaper or hear on television is about 90% negative regarding George Bush and his administration. When they are told about the intelligence, experience, qualities, and backgrounds of the senior policymakers in the Bush administration, they shake their heads. They had no idea. According to the stories in the American press, George Bush is an idiot, surrounded by incompetence, obsessed with projecting American power in Iraq and throughout the world. When they learn that none of this is true, they often appear stunned. The politics of France, Germany, and Russia toward America and Iraq have nothing whatever to do with values or principles. They are driven completely by the desire to get or keep something for nothing. They are motivated by the E factor and obsessed with getting or keeping the power and money that goes with their positions. In terms of defense, the French, Germans, and Russians have cut back on military spending year after year. Their armies are poorly trained and equipped. When they say that they will not support an American action in Iraq or Iran, much of the reason is because they have nothing to support it with. They are over-regulated, over-taxed, over-tired, and incapable of playing a role in the world. The bottom line in foreign policy is this. True friendships with other countries, such as America has with Tony Blair in England and John Howard in Australia, and with the leaders of the 30 or more other countries who support the United States in Iraq, are only really tested under fire when major issues are at stake. The idea that we need our allies is simply not true. We do not need to compromise our safety or our ideals in order to earn the support or approval of people who stab us in the back as soon as they are offered a bigger personal payout from someone like Saddam Hussein. Fair-weather friends are not worth having or working for. They will let us down again and again whenever the going gets tough or whenever they see it in their best interest to do so. As politicians, they are totally expedient in every way, completely divorced from any values or principles whatever. Economically, these countries that make every attempt to undermine and hurt us will continue to trade with us as long as this is expedient, almost as if economic relations take place on another plane, in another dimension of space. What about the United Nations? Well, virtually everyone wants to help the less fortunate. We are strongly motivated and moved by stories and pictures of hunger, disease, famine, and deprivation in other parts of the world. We want someone to do something about it, to alleviate these tragic situations. We therefore give our support to organizations that promise to alleviate suffering so that we can personally do nothing about it. This is the primary role of the United Nations. In addition, everyone wants peace. There is a natural revulsion to wars, conflicts, and the deaths and suffering that they entail. No intelligent person wants war of any kind. Most efforts by diplomats and politicians on the world stage are aimed at creating and maintaining conditions of peaceful trade and cooperation that are conducive to the greatest good for the greatest number of people. This universal desire for peace was the motivating force for the establishment of the United Nations after World War II. But the fact is that the United Nations is largely a failure in achieving either of these two noble goals. It has become a den of thieves and corruption, staffed by incompetent, dishonest, overpaid people whose primary aim in life is to get something for nothing, for themselves and for their friends, their associates, and their countries. The United Nations has a virtually unbroken record of incompetence, clumsiness, inefficiency, and corruption in virtually everything that it has ever attempted to do. It has never solved a major human problem, stopped or prevented a war or conflict, or even enforced any of its resolutions, in spite of the countless billions of dollars that have disappeared down its drain in the name of worthy causes. Every person with a position at the United Nations is lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient, and is motivated to get safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment, with a special focus on power and money, completely unconcerned about the long-term consequences of their actions or inactions. Each of them continually strives for the six P's: paychecks, perks, position, power, privileges, and pensions. The United States pays 22% of the cost of the United Nations, and aside from having one vote on the 15-member Security Council, it only has one vote out of 194 countries represented. These countries continuously outvote the U.S. and override virtually every American position. Last year, they voted the United States off the Committee for Human Rights and made Libya, one of the worst human rights violators in the world, the senior country in charge. The United Nations is a sounding board for despotic countries that manipulate its activities and sell their votes behind the scenes in exchange for monies deposited into their Swiss bank accounts. UN diplomats and staff live like kings everywhere they go. In the process of politicking and pontificating, they fly first class, stay at the best hotels, dine in the finest restaurants, and live in beautiful homes and apartments in some of the great cities of the world. They pay no taxes and cannot be arrested for crimes or even given parking tickets. They have what is called diplomatic immunity. United Nations officials are appointed politically and owe no allegiance to anyone except the person who determines whether or not they keep their job. They attend endless meetings whenever they feel like it, cast meaningless votes on unenforceable resolutions, and accomplish nothing. If the UN did not exist today and someone proposed it, knowing what they now know, it would never be approved or supported except by the parasites and bottom feeders who profit from its activities. Anyone who looks to the UN for anything of any value is either ignorant of the complete dishonesty and uselessness of it, or is totally blinded by the high-minded intentions of the organization, in spite of 60 years of failure to the contrary. Meanwhile, the United States must do what she feels is the right thing to do and stay the course. Other countries will either support us or not. Because of our desire to be liked, America has poured billions of dollars each year, totaling more than $5 trillion already into foreign aid to help these countries become more prosperous and democratic. Even though these countries vote against us in the United Nations, do everything possible to undermine our national purposes, and desert us when we ask for their support and friendship, the United States continues to send them billions of dollars of free money. They have learned over time that there's no penalty for anything they do to harm American interests. The U.S. plays a unique role in the world today. Alone amongst all nations, with its power, the United States must embrace the responsibility of assisting and protecting an ungrateful world. The government of the United States must continue to do everything possible to fight for and maintain an America that is good and beneficial for the greatest number of Americans. America and Americans have been entrusted with guarding and preserving the American dream, not only for ourselves, but for all of mankind. We must maintain America as the last best hope of mankind so that it will always be seen as the shining city upon the hill. This is the destiny of America. Summary. the road ahead. The great dilemma of our time is the growing obsession that so many people have to get something for nothing. It is bankrupting our society and the societies of every nation that has embraced the idea of free money. The idea of being able to bribe people with their own money and then put the burden of repayment onto unborn generations pits everyone against everyone, turning ordinary people into mean, vicious, demanding, and dishonest claimants to money they have not earned and do not deserve. Because we have spent so many years creating this situation of national insolvency, the solutions to our problems will be painful and difficult. But the starting point is to admit that this national and worldwide obsession to get something for nothing cannot endure. At the end of this road, if we do not turn back, lies economic and social collapse and bankruptcy. Fortunately, it's not too late. First and foremost, each person must accept responsibility for themselves, and then for America and the future. No one may stand aside and blame the situation on others. That path leads to hopelessness, victimhood, and abdication of personal accountability. Second, we must slam the door on any future something-for-nothing programs or proposals. We should only spend money that we have. Every plan to spend any money from the taxpayers and the public purse must be paid for in full in advance. We must never again commit free money to anyone that is to be paid at a later time. If we do not have the money, we do not spend it. Period. Third, we must assume from the beginning that every action is motivated by the desire to get something for nothing, and we should put the onus on any politician or activist to prove beyond a questionable doubt that he is not simply lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient, motivated by the desire to get safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment for himself the fastest and easiest way possible, with little concern for the long-term consequences of his actions. Fourth, we should go back through every public policy and program and ruthlessly weed out every something-for-nothing scheme that gives free money to anyone for any reason. We should restructure every welfare program so that recipients are required to earn the money in some way. Fifth, we should not allow anyone to get the things he wants except by engaging in behaviors based on voluntary cooperation that benefit and enhance both the individual and all others who are affected. Sixth, we must encourage a new birth of prosperity by altering or eliminating every law that hinders the entrepreneurial instincts and innovations that create hopes, jobs, and opportunities for more people. We must commit to making and maintaining the United States as the most vibrant entrepreneurial democracy in the world. Finally, the seventh prescription is that we once again commit to the American dream of freedom in all areas, of equality before the law, especially in the areas of taxes and enterprise, personal responsibility for everything that one does and becomes, self-reliance as the basis of personal pride and dignity, and limited government, which is vital to assure all the other benefits we desire. The road ahead will not be easy, but it is within our abilities to achieve any goal, overcome any obstacle, and solve any problem that we face. This is the essence of America, the can-do spirit. There are no limits except the ones we place on our own imaginations. What is necessary more than anything else is the will to do it.
We hope that you have enjoyed this audio version of Something for Nothing by Brian Tracy. This audiobook has been produced and is copyrighted by Oasis Audio. Other titles by Oasis Audio, including Killing the Sale and High Trust Selling by Todd Duncan, are available wherever audiobooks are sold and on our website, www.oasisaudio.com.